This week on Making Contact.
The real Obama was the initiator of this austerity nightmare that we're living through. A nightmare that was scripted on Wall Street. He was working from their script with their people, and we could all see it.
The election of Barack Obama generated hope for a new progressive national agenda. The reality, however, has been a disappointment for many.
Voting for Democrats as the lesser of two evils or an imperfect choice may have made some sense at certain points in history, but that was when corporate money had less of an impact in the electoral process.
On this edition, we hear excerpts of a panel discussion at this year's Left Forum, titled The 2012 Elections, Lesser Evil or Left Alternative? I'm Andrew Stelzer, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information.
Good afternoon. Power to the people.
Power to the people.
We all know that the lesser evil being referred to is Barack Obama. That's in some circles, that's his name. I'm voting for the lesser evil. We want to make it very clear that we at Black Agenda Report do not consider Barack Obama to be the lesser evil. We think of him as the more effective evil.
Longtime radio host Glenn Ford is co-founder and editor of the Black Agenda Report.
He's been more effective in evil doing than Bush in terms of protecting the citadels of corporate power and in advancing the imperial agenda. He has put both Wall Street and U.S. imperial power on new and more aggressive and destructive tracks, just as he hired himself out to do so. That was always Wall Street's expectation of Barack Obama. That was his promise to them. And that's why they gave him far more money back in 2008 than they gave to John McCain. They were buying Obama futures on the elections market. And on that deal, they made out like bandits. They invested in Obama to protect them from harm as a kind of hedge against the risk of systemic disorder that would be caused by their own predations. It was a good bet, and it was a good deal. It paid out in tens of trillions of dollars. And if you believe that what Wall Street does is evil, then Obama's service to Wall Street is evil, and there is nothing lesser about it. They vetted him thoroughly, and they did that before he even set foot in the U.S. Senate in 2004. He protected their interests there in the Senate. He helped shield corporations from class action suits, and he voted against caps on credit card interest. He was their guy back then, and some of us were saying so back then. He was the banker's guy in the Democratic primary race. Mm-hmm. Among the last three who were standing in 2008, it was Obama who opposed any kind of moratorium on home foreclosures. John Edwards was for a mandatory moratorium on housing foreclosures. Hillary Clinton, although it was a bullshit position, she was for a voluntary moratorium. But Obama said no moratorium at all, not even a voluntary one. Let this run its course. That's what candidate Obama said. And of course, it has run its course through millions and millions of families. Only a few months after that, he's still a candidate, the crunch came, and finance capital found itself in meltdown. So who stepped up to the rescue? Not George Bush. He tried, but he was spent. He was useless. He was not effective. Not John McCain. John McCain was in a coma. He was unglued, and he was totally ineffective. And so Bush's bailout failed on a Monday in October. By Friday, Obama had convinced enough Democrats who were in opposition to roll over, and the bailout passed. And that bailout set the stage for a new dispensation between the American state and Wall Street. It redefined the relationship between the American state and Wall Street, in which a permanent pipeline of tens of trillions of dollars would flow directly into Wall Street accounts via the Federal Reserve, which we all know is not an independent entity. Obama did all that, and he had not yet been elected. Obama put Social Security and Medicaid and all of the entitlements on the table in mid-January of 2009. The Republicans, if we remember, had suffered a resounding defeat. Nobody was around in a position to pressure Obama in January of 2009. But when the right was flat on its ass, Obama stood up and spoke in their stead. There was no evil devil forcing Obama to put entitlements on the chopping block. It was him. He was the evil one. And it was not a lesser evil. He was a very effective evil because the current age of austerity began on that day in mid-January of 2009 when he said all entitlements are on the table and put Social Security there. And he had not yet been sworn in as president yet. I haven't even gotten to what he did during his term as president, much less his expansion of the theaters of war and his unique assaults on international law and his massacre of due process of law in the United States. But I want to pause right here because piling up facts about the most effective evils doesn't seem to do any good when the prevailing conversation isn't really about facts. It's all about intentions. Who intends to do what? Obama has good intentions. He intends to do the right thing, or at least he intends to do better than the Republicans intend to do. It's tensions, intentions, intentions. We need to be clear about this. There is no factual basis to believe that he intends to do anything other than the same things that he has already done. Whether Democrats are in charge of the Congress or not, that is, he will continue to serve Wall Street's most fundamental interests. He has been fantastically effective at supporting the supremely evil, and so don't you dare call him a lesser evil. He's a more effective evil because black folks, historically the most progressive cohort in the United States, and liberals, and even lots of people who call themselves Marxists, let him get away with it. That is why he is so effective. The reason that I have not spoken much about the second half of Obama's first term is because that's the period when the left generally becomes disgusted, and say they're disgusted, with what they call his excessive compromises and his cave-ins to Republicans. But that is a profoundly wrong reading of the reality, that he compromised and he caved in. He was simply continuing down his own road to austerity, the road that he himself had initiated before even taking office. The only person that was caving in and compromising to the Republicans was the Obama that many on the left had made up in their heads. That Obama never existed. And so it becomes even more ridiculous to psychoanalyze a non-existent person. The real Obama was the initiator of this austerity nightmare that we're living through, a nightmare that was scripted on Wall Street and which provided the core of Obama's policy team from the very beginning. He was working from their script with their people, and we could all see it. That's why Obama's so-called financial reform was so diligent in making sure that derivatives were virtually untouched. We are structurally in the same situation with the same house of cards that is going to fall probably in much more catastrophic ways. The real Barack Obama retained Bush's Secretary of War because the real Barack Obama was determined to repackage the imperial enterprise and to expand the scope and to expand the theaters of war. He would then dress up the war machine, dress it up head to foot in a chador of humanitarianism, and march deeper and deeper into Africa. He'd make merciless and totally unprovoked war against Libya. And then he would tell Congress that there had been no war at all. What war? And also that it was none of their damn business. And he got away with that. Now that is the most effective evil warmonger imaginable. So don't call him a lesser evil. He is awesomely evil. Obama has advanced the corporatization of the public schools beyond George Bush's wildest dreams. He has methodically constructed a national parallel system of charter schools that in practice is undermining and subverting the traditional public schools. And in some places, they have replaced or are about to replace the traditional public schools. The hedge funds and the billionaires are ecstatic about that because they are helping facilitate that. And yet the teachers' union endorses their own undertaker, foolishly believing that he is a lesser evil. So what does the left do in the election cycle? That's part of what this panel is supposed to address. The left, I say, should do what it is supposed to do here in the belly of the beast at all times, and that is to disarm the beast. That is our singular, unique duty, not to advise the beast, not to speak with the beast, but to disarm the beast. At this time in the world clock, that means ripping the farcical humanitarian veil from the face of U.S. war planning, and that is Obama's face. No genuine anti-war activist can endorse the actual warmonger, Obama. If you want to resist actual imperial wars, you must fight Obama, period. Anything else is to endorse or acquiesce in his wars. If the question is, what do we do on an election year? You can join in working to stop Obama from doing a repeat of Libya in Syria. You can say no to military action and embargoes against Syria and Iran. That's what you can do this election year. If the Green Party or any party firmly opposes Obama's humanitarian Orwellian farce, then support them. And I'm confident that they will. We have to fight Obama because he's not just the more effective evil. He is the actual evil that we have, fighting actual wars against actual victims all around the world and against us here at home. If you're going to fight for anything, you've got to fight for the right to fight. And that is in danger. The very right to struggle is in danger today. And that means fighting for the rule of law. So if you don't plan to go underground or go into exile anytime soon, you've got to fight this president because he is the one who claims the right to imprison or kill any person of any nationality, any place at any time on earth for reasons that are known only to him. This man has excelled George Bush by shepherding preventive detention through Congress. Barack Obama is the more effective evil. We have to fight him during the election year and fight him again every year that he is here. Power to the people.
That was Glenn Ford, co-founder and editor of the Black Agenda Report. We'll be right back. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. Because of listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the U.S., Canada, and South Africa. To find out how to support us, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. We now return to a panel discussion titled The 2012 Elections, Lesser Evil or Left Alternative? From the Left Forum in New York City. Up next, we hear from Black Agenda Report columnist Margaret Kimberly.
Good afternoon. The argument in favor of voting for Democrats as the lesser of two evils or an imperfect choice may have made some sense at certain points in history, but that was when corporate money had less of an impact in the electoral process. So the argument doesn't really hold water anymore. There was a time when the lines of demarcation between the two parties were clearer. Democratic presidents signed the legislation which gave us Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. Democrats supported labor unions and civil rights legislation. But now we have a different story altogether. We now have had two Democratic presidents who are undermining very basic tenets which were long held by the Democratic Party. These policies of Clinton and now Obama are in direct contradiction to what their supporters want them to do. Bill Clinton gave us welfare reform, an attack on poor and working people. He also gave us the end of regulations in the financial services industry, which resulted in devastated economies and lives all around the world. And, of course, we can't forget the rapid growth in the prison system population due to harsher criminal penalties for drug convictions, which all began under the Clinton watch. Now we have Barack Obama's collusion with Republicans to cut even entitlement program, and once again in direct opposition to what his voters wanted him to do. There was a time when the imperfect Democrats supported constitutionally protected civil liberties. But recently, the Democratic president's attorney general said, at a law school no less, that due process rights guaranteed under the Constitution don't prevent the president from assassinating any one of us if he so chose. And he wouldn't even have to bother charging or indicting us first. So much for the benefits of having a constitutional law professor in the White House. So then, what do we do? I think it's best to keep this as simple as possible because Obama and the Democrats are making our choices easier and easier. Should a leftist do any of the following? Support a president who claims a right to kill you. Support a party which continues and expands America's aggression toward the rest of the world. Support a party which allows millions of people to be unemployed without fighting for policies which would produce new jobs. Support a party which privatizes public schools, destroys the teaching profession, and the public education system. I could go on, but you should get the point by now. The Democrats are now like the Republicans of old, and our reasons to support them without question make less and less sense. And there's another point I would like to emphasize, and that is that our system is far more broken than many of us are willing to acknowledge. It is an open question, frankly, whether or not we still have what we think of as a democracy. Rich people decide who will run for office at all levels of government. This presidential election campaign is expected to cost $1 billion, and that means that only the rich have a seat at the table. Now, that statement is not one that should make us throw up our hands and give up, but rethink what we ought to do. It means we ought to pay less attention to corporate media-made manufactured opinion and phony outrage, which makes life easier for the people at the top when they decide where to pillage and plunder next. If we are distracted because Newt Gingrich calls Barack Obama the food stamp president, or faint because X number of Republicans still believe that Obama is a Muslim born outside of the United States, then their dirty work is all the more easy for them to accomplish. We're asking the wrong questions altogether. We can debate how leftists should vote or act in an election year, but perhaps it's time to ask different things. How does change really come about in the United States? And it's a very simple answer. It has always come from the power of mass movements, and we forget now, but the demands of those mass movements were sometimes directed at Democrats. President Johnson responded to popular demand when he signed the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act. The people who took to the streets to demand their citizenship rights didn't shake in their boots at the prospect of taking a Democrat to task. They made their voices heard, and as a result, we're all beneficiaries of their actions today. We're the beneficiaries because they didn't worry about protecting people in power. They told the people in power what they expected them to do and never worried for one moment that their demands were in any way unreasonable. We should be their heirs. Instead of reacting like one of Pavlov's dogs when a Republican makes a racist statement about Obama, our focus must be on our demands and on the well-being of the people in this country and in the world.
That was Margaret Kimberly, columnist for the Black Agenda Report. Up next, Suren Moodliar, the coordinator of Massachusetts Global Action.
Okay, so I want to make an argument during this talk to argue for a deal between minor parties and major parties. Previous to this talk, I would have said between the left alternative and the lesser of the two evils. And so so now I'll change the language a little bit. Very quickly, though, why argue for a deal and what's the basis for a deal? What I'm experiencing is a deep sense of frustration. Essentially, I've been in this country for about 25 years now, and every election cycle, the same arguments play out, and with each succeeding cycle, the left is no stronger. In fact, it's often a lot weaker. So taking that into account, I'd like to figure out if there's a way for us to be stronger in the next election cycle without bearing the scar that Ralph Nader, I think, continues to bear, that is being blamed for the delivery of the election to George W. Bush. Whether or not that's accurate, and I don't think it's accurate, that imposes a major tax, if you will, on the left as they argue for building an independent left. Now, I do think that there is a way for us to sort of break out of this cycle. So what are the ways in which a progressive alternative can build the fight back? In other words, I'm not questioning the notion that we have to fight back. I'm not questioning the notion that we have to build an independent left. The question is how. So it's one thing to say we need to oppose the wars. It's a completely different thing to find us a viable strategy for opposing those wars. Essentially, what we usually engage in are three kinds of things in terms of dealing with the Democrats. One, we plead with them to change their platform to have the kind of language, the kind of policies we'd like to have in it. And usually that provides absolutely no guidance, at least not since 1978, has provided any kind of guidance. So I don't think tinkering with their platform is a useful goal for the left. Another strategy is the safe state strategy, right? Let's compete in those states where our participation makes no difference. You know, and I just don't see that as being useful. One of the good things about an election is that it creates a sense of urgency. It creates a point around which you can rally people. But rallying people where they won't make a difference denies that incentive, denies that urgency. Another strategy, which I'm not entirely sort of opposed to, is a litmus test. If the candidate opposes, and then it could be our preferred strategy or our preferred policies, if they oppose this war, we'll support them. So we'll support a Kucinich. All of these three things, though, I believe deprive us of any opportunity to actually build a left party or any kind of left alternative. And what does it deprive us of in practical terms? It deprives us of the ability to go out there, speak to people door to door. It deprives us of the experience of running those campaigns. It deprives us of the human capital needed to build the left alternative. So I'd like to argue for a deal, and not the usual one. The usual deals that we tend to make with the Democrats is we pretend to protest, you pretend to listen. And that is the normal process. It happens repeatedly. It happens with small nonprofits approaching city governments. You know, they'll say, for example, we are going to oppose the bus fare hikes. We're going to oppose this or that. And in the end, they'll celebrate a major victory when the fee structure gets altered to protect this or that group. In the meantime, transportation policy as a whole remains the same. So not that kind of a deal. Instead, what I'm proposing is a concrete, verifiable, and immediate deal. Our power lies in the power they've given us, the power to be spoilers in elections. Our ability to spoil an election, to deprive the major party of victory because we have run our own candidate. To the extent that we wield that power in a genuine and credible way, we then become potential partners for deals. I think the best mechanism for concentrating that power is an unsafe state strategy. For us to concentrate our resources on those states where we may deprive the major party that we wish to make a deal with of victory. So, you know, running in Pennsylvania, Ohio, Florida, etc. But leaving ourselves open to withdrawing from the race when the other side is prepared to make a deal that we want. So concentrating our resources, running a credible campaign, and when we believe that we are going to get the deal we want, we can choose to pull out. If we don't get the deal we want, we spoil that election. But when we spoil that election, when we deprive the other side of victory, we don't have responsibility for spoiling the election. The people who have spoiled the election are those people who refuse to make the deal, the major party. There are all sorts of mechanisms for doing this, including thinking about concentrating in the unsafe states, but also specifying a kind of deal that we can talk with to the public. In other words, it's not a backroom deal. It's not a cigar-filled room kind of deal. It's a deal in which we move for major reforms to the electoral system. So since most states and state legislatures get to determine the kinds of rules for elections within their states, it allows us to have the Democrats provide a reform of that electoral system in anticipation of us running a candidate. Or if they choose not to make this or that electoral reform, then they have deprived themselves of potentially our votes and they've earned our opposition in more ways than they usually earn our opposition. The key thing is that the deal must not be dependent on a reward to be distributed after the election. We have no power after the election. The deal must be made well in advance of the election, and both sides need to be able to verify it. What does it mean to reach a deal with the Democrats? It means that they take responsibility for their platform, and we take responsibility for our platform. We don't endorse their platform. We don't say that they're the lesser of two evils. What we say is, in exchange for our votes, in exchange for our support, we are getting a reform that will help us move forward. So that, I think, is the only way to move forward with the deal. Make it concrete, verifiable, and immediate. Thanks.
That was Suren Moodliar, the coordinator of Massachusetts Global Action. And that's it for this edition of Making Contact. Special thanks to People of Color Organize for the recording of this panel discussion at the 2012 Left Forum. For a CD copy of this program, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736 or check out our website, radioproject.org, to get a podcast, download past shows, or make a difference by supporting our work. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.